set up and tore down this stage with my own two hands. We've traveled this land, packed tight in minivans, and all this for the fans, girls, money and fame. I played their game and had to scream my name. I will show no shame. I live and die for this, and if I come off soft, fix you on this.
Are you scared?
Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Simon Schuster, Jacob Kanzler, and Mike Malott. A little later, Dennis Paradise, he is with Michigan State University's Institute for Health Policy. He's going to be joining us to talk about the Affordable Care Act and the various changes that the Senate, U.S. Senate, would like to make to it. But first, guys, I was on vacation last week, thank God, because otherwise I would have had to make the decision about whether this Kid Rock thing is for real or not. Jacob, you got your hand in your head because it was something that I'm sure you hope you didn't have to deal with. Is this really serious or is this just a marketing ploy?
Well, last we saw, I mean, unless I've missed some news, but there was a number of announcements last week involving a restaurant opening in the Little Caesars Arena, a couple of music videos, and that Kid Rock release, but so far not a confirmed run for the U.S. Senate seat in Michigan. The conversation that played out in the newsroom last week was one that you would hope that other news outlets would make. You kind of need to take Kid Rock at his word. He said that the website he put out, Kid Rock for Senate, is real, does not mean that he is running for Senate. And so we debated that back and forth in the newsroom and wanted to kind of play it straight and also just I think we mentioned the fact whether he was running for Senate or a marketing ploy, and so far it looks like it's been a marketing ploy.
You were skeptical from the onset, from what I understand.
Yeah, I mean, at first blush, to be honest with you, I was somewhat convinced that he's planning a Senate run. You click, you know, the website, it looks like a campaign site at first. You click on it, there's a merchandise link, and there's yard signs and bumper stickers, and I think a t-shirt and a hat. But when you get down to the actual meat of it, you realize that the merchandise site is on his record label's website. There are no FEC filings, there's no campaign committee. The website has the caption, "Are you scared?" And slogans like, "Pimp of the Nation." And then you realize that when he says that absolutely, yes, this website is real, there's no omission that he's running for Senate. And I think that the media really did themselves a disservice in this by jumping the gun. And I had seen a lot of tweets out there that says that, you know, he's either toying with a run for Senate or that we need to take it seriously. But I will take it seriously when he demonstrates seriousness in a candidacy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think where we can show is a marketing ploy is besides the first day story where a lot of people, you know, assume that Kid Rock was making a Senate run, I think there was still some mystery. So I think that prompted some reporters to kind of do some digging. And that's where we found out about the potential Little Caesars Arena restaurant. And then there was a lot of attention on him when he announced the music video. So certainly, I think from his aspect, it worked as a marketing ploy because once he got everyone's attention with this alleged Senate run, whether or not that was true, it kind of forced a lot of reporters to kind of keep an eye on him and see what he was about to say, and obviously that got him a lot of free media.
Well, I think, Mike, we've got some of ourselves to blame on this because I go back to the Republican convention that we had in the winter, and there was this story about Kid Rock for U.S. Senate that had been put out there. We had one delegate, Wes Nakagiri, just throw out the suggestion, wouldn't it be great if we could get somebody like Kid Rock to be a candidate for the U.S. Senate? And somehow that went into some kind of viral national story as if Kid Rock was running for the U.S. Senate in the state of Michigan.
There's always all kinds of talk and speculation about who's running, and you really have to be careful about whether or not people are really interested or whether or not they're really serious about it. And there's a lot of motivations for somebody in the public eye to get their name out there. Whether he's serious or not, it generates publicity for him, and he benefits from publicity.
And other folks who were trying to join on the publicity train, one Lena Epstein put out a one-minute video in which she tries to encourage Kid Rock to campaign with her and maybe have a drink with her, but she can't drink alcohol right now because she's pregnant. But we can go out there and have a electronic guitar solo of the Star Spangled Banner and have some grainy video and trying gravy train on this. And she wasn't the only one, Simon. We also had Debbie Stabenow fundraise extensively off this news, and I've got to believe that she got some success off it.
Yeah, I think that really what this is going to boil down to is great news for Democrats because it, I mean, Kid Rock is really kind of Trump extended to another degree in terms of if you're looking for a politician who's focused on policy, cares about his personal image and upstanding moral character, Kid Rock is not necessarily your guy. He's had a sex tape. He's had assault charges. He's not, you know, the sort of squeaky clean candidate like Lena Epstein's professional background, for example. She's not someone who's, you know, ever been roiled in controversy or same with Bob Young, for example. And I think that this could complicate the field for them. Whereas for Democrats, it makes an excellent scare tactic and a pretty good fundraising ploy.
Let's move on to this clean Michigan government proposal that Brian Kelly is circulating. He's revamped his ballot language and presumably circulating this new language and collecting signatures. One thing, though, that I think is striking about this proposal has to do with the way that the new legislature would have to get its pay adjusted. I think we all know that legislators don't control how much they earn, and that is determined by the State Officers Compensation Commission, otherwise known as SOC. And SOC is a constitutional body. It is mentioned in the Constitution that it meets every 2 years for 15 session days, and it makes recommendations on whether the legislature, the governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, secretary of states, and the Supreme Court justices, how much they should make. And once they make the recommendation, the legislature has the opportunity to say yes or no. Now, it didn't used to be this way. In fact, when the legislature got a 38% pay increase back in 2000, the process was SOC made a recommendation, and unless the legislature acted, the recommendations just went into effect. Well, after that 38% pay increase, the legislature decided, well, we're not going to take any more political advantage on this, so this is what we're going to do. So when SOC makes a recommendation, we have to approve it. And if we don't approve it, if both the House and the Senate doesn't approve the recommendations that SOC brings forward, then they don't go into effect. Now, since this change was made in 2002, there's only been one chance, or there's only been one time where a SOC recommendation was actually approved, and that was in the Jennifer Granholm years when she and the legislature took a 10% pay cut during the Great Recession. Now, I mention this because as part of the ballot proposal from Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly, it says in here that SOC, as soon as it is practical, that's what the language says, must come together and determine what the legislative salary should be based on the average public school teacher salary. However, it doesn't change the fact that the legislature still has to approve its SOC recommendation. So, Simon, this creates a situation where the legislature will still have to affirmatively cut their pay in half in order for their pay to be cut in half.
It really turns the idea, one of his fundamental tenets of, you know, the part-time legislature proposal is about reducing the size of government. And part of that would be probably be reducing, if they're going to work less, they should be paid less. But this turns this that objective into more of a gesture than a guarantee. And I think that that could create some uncertainty, especially with the conflicting constitutional language. There could run into serious issues.
And I'll talk about that, what you just mentioned there about conflicts in the Constitution, in just a second. But, Mike, I want to ask you about this, too, because it creates a situation here where Kelly is now putting public pressure on the legislature to cut their pay when they are really under no obligation to do so.
Right. If they don't cut their pay, then they're in a position where it looks like they're overriding a vote of the people.
But on the other hand, these are people who, when they decide to get this job, thought they were going to be signing up for a $70,000 a year full-time job.
And nobody who has a position is going to be eager to cut their pay, especially by that amount. Anybody who's in the legislature wants to stay there as long as they're allowed to. I'm a little confused by this. If it's unintentional that he's written it this way, then it shows that it's not a well-thought-out proposal. You're basically requiring the SOCC to recommend something, but not the legislature to follow it. So that shows that it's not well-thought-out, or is it? Is he purposely setting up the legislature to have to face a vote in which it's going to have to choose between following what the public wants or having a decent salary. I can't tell from this what the intent is.
Here's another issue that we saw as we were just looking through this ballot language. It says the commission shall meet as soon as practical to determine the salary for legislators, and the commission being SOC, for calendar years 2019 and 2020, consistent with this paragraph. And I'm not a legal expert, but it does not change the section of the state constitution dealing with SOC, which states that if the salary and expense determinations are approved or amended, as provided in this section, the salary and expense determinations shall become effective for the legislative session immediately following the next general election. So, Simon, again, I'm not, you know, I didn't go to law school or anything, but just from reading this, you have one section then, if adopted, would change legislative salaries for immediate 2019 and 2020, while another section says that these things couldn't take effect until 2021.
Yeah, and certainly it would bring up the question of which one would supersede the other. But it also brings up the question of, essentially, they're not bound to necessarily be held to this prorated standard beyond the two calendar years that the ballot language mentions. If they're going to scale it to a public teacher's salary, then it's at SOC's discretion what that scaling should be, and then what the prorating should be as well. So beyond those two calendar years, they could easily, if SOC decided to, revert to a previous pay scale.
Again, I'm not a legal expert, but I think that these are a couple things, Mike, that kind of go to your point. Has every wrinkle been ironed out of this ballot proposal, or are there other things in here like this that another side could come and challenge the language if it does get the signatures, if it is brought before the State Board of Canvassers, and ultimately maybe the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court?
It sounds like it's setting up a legal fight with these two conflicting provisions in the Constitution. You're going to have an instant legal challenge, I would think. Odd that it's been written that way. I think it just shows that it's just not been well thought out.
All right. Well, let's move on to the interview portion of the podcast. Segueing us there is, of course, the illustrious Senator Kid Rock.
Devil without a cause, and I'm back with the beaver hats and Ben Davis slacks. 30-pack of straws, 30-pack of hoes. No Rogaine in the propane flows. The chosen one, I'm the living proof with the gift of gab from the city of truth. I jab and stab and not critic.
Joining us now on the podcast is Dennis Paradise. He is with the MSU Institute or Health Policy. He's also worked for the Osteopathic Society and other health-related organizations here in town. No stranger to Lansing or health policy. And we thought we'd have him here to dissect what's going on with the Affordable Care Act. Thanks for joining us on the program today.
Happy to be here. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, why don't you give our listeners a little update on where we are with the Senate plan to mess around with the Affordable Care Act and how this is different from what the House kicked out.
Well, there are not that many differences if you look at the end game. The end game in the House and the end game in the Senate is the same. It is to primarily back away from the commitment that expanded health care in what we call the Healthy Michigan program, the Medicaid expansion program. It is to put limitations on the amount of money that the federal government will contribute to the Medicaid program in a downward slope that will force states in the future to make decisions about where they can cut Medicaid.
So this is really pushing costs down to the state level is what this is about, by lessening the burden on federal government.
That is absolutely correct. The Affordable Care Act, the intent of the Affordable Care Act was to extend health care coverage, including Medicaid coverage, to as many people as possible. The purpose of the House Republican bill and the Senate Republican bill, the Better Health Reconciliation Act, is to do exactly the opposite. It is to reduce the number of people who have coverage, primarily through Medicaid, but also some of the middle class individuals who lose health care coverage because they'll lose the subsidies that currently support it.
So based on what you've been able to tell from the Senate version, it's going to be like the House version in that it's going to be very difficult for the state of Michigan to continue
the Healthy Michigan program as it is.
Oh, guaranteed. The Senate version and the House version both say we're going to do away with the funding that supports the Healthy Michigan program.
So basically the state would have to generate that money or end the program.
That's correct. The estimate from the Michigan Association of Health Plans is it would be an $800 million cut to the Medicaid program, which means the state of Michigan would then have to come up with $800 million just to sustain the program at the level it is now.
And just for our listeners' benefit, $800 million compared to a general fund budget of $10 billion, we're talking about, I don't know, maybe 8, 9%. I'm just kind of doing the math off the top of my head. They would have to grow the general fund by 8 or 9% just to continue Healthy Michigan under this particular plan.
That's correct. If this plan went into full effect, but it's not just Healthy Michigan, it's all the Medicaid cuts.
Oh, okay. Because I was just thinking Healthy Michigan. What kind of cuts would we see in the Medicaid program in general?
Well, that's somewhat of an unknown because the, quote, state flexibility that comes with decreased federal funding says you, the state of Michigan, have to decide where you're going to make these cuts. So it's not altogether clear. While it is clear that funding for Healthy Michigan would go away, it is not clear how Michigan would react to decreased federal funding in the Medicaid budget. Clearly, it would have to either raise revenues, which, as you indicated, is extraordinarily difficult. We just learned that with the roads, Michigan roads situation. Or, conversely, it would have to cut benefits, cut enrollees, or cut provider payments. The people who have very major concerns about the opioid epidemic are really upset about this. The behavioral health folks can see major cuts coming their way. The rural health, the entire rural health infrastructure feels at risk, and that's the reason that Protect My Care is doing a public hearing next week in Gaylord to give the rural community opportunity to come together and express their concerns and pass those concerns on to their legislators.
One of the concerns that Republicans have made about the Affordable Care Act is that we are headed toward a system of a single-payer system where we're just going to have a socialized, eventually, if we don't do anything, we are going to have a socialized healthcare system. Is that a trend that you see we as a nation approaching?
I think that is, when all else fails, that's where we're going to wind up. Many people viewed the Affordable Care Act as the last hope for the private insurance companies. The Affordable Care Act went out of its way to make sure that people who couldn't afford health care insurance got Medicaid, or people got subsidies to buy private health care insurance. If we're going to do away with those subsidies, people are not going to be able to buy health care insurance. There's going to be a larger uninsured population. That goes with the Medicaid population, which is also going to have decreased funding, and there'll be more uninsured that'll result from that. So let's assume that we as a country want to get to a point where everyone's got coverage. I would argue that the Senate package is taking us in the opposite direction. We are seeing more uninsured.
So while the critics of the American Health Care Act are, there's a broad coalition of them, but it's not universal, there's almost universal agreement that the Affordable Care Act needs reforms, that it's not a complete piece of policy as it stands today. What do you believe would reflect a more responsible system of reforms?
You raise a good point. In my lack of support for the House Republican plan and the Senate Republican plan, I have to agree with you completely. The Affordable Care Act is not perfect. It needs corrections. The first place that we need to go is the where the Republicans tell us that Obamacare is dead, and that is the small market reform, the support for the small markets that are trying to get people into health care insurance by giving them subsidies. Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, got that wrong. There needs to be some fine-tuning to make that work. Does that mean Obamacare is dead? Not by a long shot. This is a relatively small piece of the Affordable Care Act overall.
So you're of the position that while the Affordable Care Act has its errors, that it's and is obviously an imperfect piece of policy, that it can be shaped up into something that has it's more sustainable.
There is no doubt about that. The question we are having now is not how do we get to a better system of health care. The debate that we are having now in Congress is, do we try to extend health care benefits to everybody in this country the way every other developed country has been able to do? Or do we go the other way, which is what's being proposed both in the House and the Senate, and take health care benefits away from people and create more uninsured in this country?
I want to go back to something you said about the Affordable Care Act being the last stand for insurance companies or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
Can you expand on that a little bit? Do you feel like if it were not for the Affordable Care Act, we would have really no choice than to put, let's just say, everybody on Medicaid and become the kind of single-payer system we see across the world?
Well, that is the logical endpoint, unless we as a country are willing to say, okay, there's going to be 20 million people in this country that are not going to have health care coverage because we don't want to pay for it. In the past, the way government got into health care is there were people who could not get coverage. Poor people, because they couldn't afford it, and the elderly, because health insurance was too expensive. And the government stepped in to provide health care to those two groups. Now we're seeing that group of uninsured growing. Why is that? Well, one, wages are not keeping up with the cost of health care. And two, the cost of health care is rising meteorically. So we are seeing a bigger and bigger gap in people who don't have insurance. Now, will government step in and fill that gap again? The Affordable Care Act tried to do that. It said, all right, the government's going to give you subsidies, private individual, to help you buy insurance. The Republican proposals are saying, no, we're going to take those subsidies away. We're going to have more uninsured.
Why was the Affordable Care Act, do you believe, why didn't it take that next step to put everybody on some kind of Medicaid program? Was that just what was politically feasible at the time? The insurance companies basically had a significant pushback and said, hey, listen, we got to be a part of this too?
Well, politics is the art of the possible. And I think the Affordable Care Act did what it could at the time. It went out of its way to try to keep the private health insurance as a central point in the American health care delivery system. Some people would argue that probably wasn't the way to go. If your primary interest is the most efficient health care delivery system you can have, you go to a single-payer system.
That is how Americans in general save more money.
That will save the system more money. However, it will also cost us several jobs, because a lot of those cost savings that we're going to be realizing by going to a single-payer system are going to be the army of clerical people that make our current patchwork system work.
So this question is more of a personal one. You've represented the Michigan's healthcare industry, and you've also worked as a Republican policy staffer. What made you arrive at the conclusion that a single-payer system is the logical next step?
I say it's a logical next step only if the current system fails. This country, we really, really value the private health insurance market. We have gone out of our way to try to protect it. I would argue that the Affordable Care Act has gone out of its way to try to incorporate it into the solution of getting everyone coverage. But what if it fails? Where do we go next? And that's where I say an all-payer system, I think, would be the fallback. Fallback that nobody really, well, I shouldn't say nobody. It has its supporters, but it also has its detractors. I'm not saying that's the preferred solution. I'm saying that might be the final solution.
And what do you see as getting us to a point where we would have a single-payer system? If the Republicans have their way, they pass this plan, we have more uninsured, and it would just be a complete backlash to the response to the backlash?
Well, as a country, we have this debate every 15 years, so we may have to wait 15 years to know okay. What comes next. If the Republicans are successful, we're going to go through a period where we have a lot more uninsured. There's going to be a lot more cost shifting. People who are paying their health insurance benefits will also be subsidizing the uninsured who can't pay for their health care benefits. And I think overall we will find that at the end of the day, at the end of that 15-year period, we're going to find that to be highly unsatisfactory in terms of a solution. At that point, what do we do? Where do we go next? That's where I was suggesting that I think the discussion at that point, the single-payer system gets much more reality-based than it is currently.
For our listeners' benefit, explain what you're doing right now for the MSU Institute on for Health Policy.
Well, a variety of things, actually, but a few that are of particular interest in this case. I'm serving as executive director for an organization called Protect My Care, MI Care. And that organization is intended to do exactly what we're doing today, try to understand what the impact would be if the Republican proposals were to pass, or if we were to truly seek out ways to improve the Affordable Care Act, which needs to happen. So that's where I'm spending a lot of my time today.
And you're doing this now, even though you retired, quote unquote, in 2010.
Well, I retired, but I discovered I'm not good at retirement. So fortunately, Michigan State University made me an offer, which worked out well in terms of my interest in health policy.
And so prior to MSU, you were at the Michigan Osteopathic Society, and you've also got some other experience in healthcare as well. Tell our listeners about that.
Oh, now we're going to the way back machine. I have worked 13 years as executive director of the Michigan Osteopathic Association, had 2 years as deputy director of what was then the Michigan Association of HMOs, now the Michigan Association of Health Plans. Let's see, 10 years at the as the head of government relations for the Michigan Hospital Association, a few years, 7 years with the Michigan State Medical Society. So, and two stints in the legislature, one for working for Lansing Senator Bill Cederberg and one working for the House Republican office. This was back just after the Civil War, actually. But.
Who would have thought that going back into history to getting all your jobs would have been the toughest part of the interview? I'm guessing I'm glad I saved that for the end. Well, Dennis, I appreciate you joining us here on the podcast today. Dennis Paradise with the Michigan State Institute on Health Policy.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. If your listeners are interested, 1 week from this broadcast, which would be the July 24th in Gaylord, the Protect My Care is holding a public hearing and asking individuals from that area who are very concerned, rightfully concerned about the impact of the Senate plan on rural health care to come together, share their concerns, and let us formulate a message that we can pass on to the our members of Congress.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Dennis Paradise for joining us for the podcast. And Simon, you're bright-eyed and bushy-tailed today from a weekend of music, and I don't think that you were listening to Kid Rock in Chicago.
Not quite. I was in Chicago for the Pitchfork Music Festival. I got in at about 5:30 this morning, and I have to say that their song selection, while it spans many genres at that festival, it's a bit more refined than what Kid Rock puts out.
Oh, refined. Come now. I mean, what can scream more Michigander than a little Kid Rock? I mean, you got to go to Chicago in order to hear refined music?
Well, no, not at all, but I don't know, just, I guess American Badass doesn't quite do it for me.
I gotta tell you what, Mike, in full disclosure, I had to buy off iTunes this Kid Rock song because I don't know any Kid Rock.
I have avoided his music for many, many years, and I will continue to do so.
Now,
especially if he becomes a senator.
That said, I think the owners of MERS have a little different experience with Kid Rock. I think Michelle's a big fan.
Really?
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, Michelle's a big fan.
I have to say, though, and this was first floated by Craig Mauger, a former news MERS staffer, that I would be really looking forward to seeing a debate stage which consisted of Lena Epstein, Bob Young, and Kid Rock.
Just Bob Young and Kid Rock would be hilarious. Bow tie versus a long straggly hair. Would you think he'd need to get a haircut or not? Or that would hurt his persona, wouldn't it?
I think that if he were to actually run a serious campaign, Kyle, he would have to stick to his guns completely because there is enough of a lyrical record out there and a court run to show that his character has very much been set.
I say that the only way Kid Rock runs is if Ted Nugent runs for governor.
Oh, Now you're scaring me.
All right, well, that's going to do for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Till next week, I'm Kyle Malone. Take care. Hey, 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 hey. I put Detroit City back on the map for singing. Hey.